Welcome to Eager Feet, the podcast where we move from the mundane to the sublime and back. And I'm here today with Jonathan Kennelly. Jonathan is a father of five. He has his own accounting firm. He's based in Auckland. And I came across Jonathan in a Facebook post that went sort of semi-viral that he posted recently on COVID-19, looking at death rates in Sweden. So Jonathan, maybe just as a starting question, what's a guy like you doing looking up death rates in Sweden?
I guess numbers are my thing. Right at the start, when this is all sort of going down and we're all wondering, is it something, is it just another scare tactic or is it a media beat up? It wasn't really until the suggested lockdown came along that I really took any notice of it, really, because being in the profession that I am in, I guess I have my ear to the ground in terms of economic consequences to businesses, particularly small, medium businesses, which affect New Zealand the most. Well, New Zealand is mainly made up of small to medium businesses. So that's why I started looking, and I hit for numbers, so it came a bit more naturally to me. And I just don't think anyone, as you said, went semi-viral. It seemed to get a fair bit of attention because people just aren't looking or don't always know where to look other than their TV for information.
So why Sweden, and what did you find? What were you looking for?
Because time is limited, I tried to narrow down exactly the most basic way to quantify whether or not a lockdown is mandatory. Essentially, when it's told, most countries around the world have implemented a lockdown of one form or another. So if you look at Sweden, who hasn't, they've essentially have sensible citizen-based, citizens have chosen to practice social distancing, and they've also sort of protected their elderly and their frail. They are essentially the test case of what happens if lockdown doesn't get implemented. So if they come through without hysterical consequences, then at least at the very bottom line, at least we can't say that lockdown is mandatory. So what did I find? What I've found is that even as at today's date, their total deaths for 2020 hasn't even actually caught up to 2018 at the same date. Now that is likely to change. I would be surprised if 2020 doesn't eventually surpass 2018, because we know COVID-19 has an advantage because there is no immunity, and it seems to be a fairly aggressive. All I'm doing is questioning whether or not it's aggressive enough to justify the hysteria that then justifies a lockdown. And in Sweden so far, that just doesn't seem to be the case. It just doesn't. And, people say, well, what about the UK? What about New York? Which seem to be outliers in many respects, if the data coming out of them is to be believed. But to be honest, I don't, in terms of what I've been looking at, I can just say, I don't care. All I'm showing is that in some circumstances, obviously, if Sweden doesn't fall over and will, become a basket case, then lockdown is not a universal requirement, because clearly it's not necessary in all locations, or not justified in all locations.
Can you say anything more about how you got the data and Sweden's sort of data collection?
Yes, in fact, I'm just going straight to the source, straight to the Swedish stats. I don't know what they call it. I put a link on the article. They update it once a week. I've remove the latest 10 days because they tend to lag. So if I were to add on a few extra days to what I have, I think last time I updated it was on the 16th because, and that was what, anything beyond 10 days ago tends to have pretty up-to-date data. They don't tend to add too many deaths on further down the track. Yes, there's a gap over the last few weeks between 2018 and 2020. And I imagine that gap will stay for a while until it dissipates. That's not a spike. And there was a gap the other way around earlier on in the year. You know, the official data shows that 2018 had significantly more deaths earlier on in the year for quite a number of weeks. And now we're seeing a catch-up, essentially, on the other side. And that sort of contrasts, I think there's a very popular article going around at the moment, which is trying to do the same thing, compare all cause deaths for various places, of various countries to the average 5-year all cause death rates. And it shows these remarkable spikes in quite a number of locations. I don't know if you've seen it yourself.
No, I haven't seen that one. No.
No, I've been sent it by a lot of people because obviously it's, you know, sort of to try and counteract what I'm saying. For a start, the article confirms that Sweden has the lesser of all the cases, which is for kind of confirms my view anyway that the lockdown clearly then isn't the cure that everyone thinks it is. But also, even their data for Sweden seems a little bit, well, quite frankly, their spike is higher than what I have, and my data is just straight out stats from the Swedish government, from their health department. So I am questioning, I need to look further into their article to see whether, I know they're getting places from Istanbul where they're basically doing an estimation of how many people are being buried or cremated. You know, that very sort of spurious under data that then gets extrapolated across the population, which then gives them a lovely spike, that sort of thing. Whereas I'm just going straight back to deaths, which the Swedish are great at keeping a record of, much better than other countries.
Is this other article looking at all deaths rates from everything?
Yeah, correct, all cause deaths.
Yeah,
I was grateful that at least people have cottoned on to actually, because the murkiness of did they die of CV19 or die with CV19? That is massive muddying, and we know in New York now there's a huge incentive to diagnose with everyone with a CV19 because they get $39,000 from the government, from the federal government per case.
Right.
You know, so there's distortion all over the place. Even before that, there's a bias because, you know, it's on everyone's mind. So there just seems to be a bias in general. So maybe that explains some of London, New York. For a while, I was thinking maybe it's a density thing, but then actually if you count up the deaths in the 10 most densely populated cities in the world, across the world, all of whom would have had just as much contact with Wuhan as New York or London, you would have thought. And there's like a total death count of 983 as of today's date or something. So it doesn't, I don't know, New York and London, I admit, they are outliers. Hopefully the data comes through eventually, all cause death data shows things one way or another. But as like I said, doesn't matter. To my case, doesn't matter. If Sweden is not the basket case, then the lockdown is clearly not the mandatory cure across the board.
And so why would you take 2018 and not take an average that you're comparing the stats to?
Because 2018 for Sweden, at least to today's date, was the heaviest in terms of deaths. And people say, oh, well, that's cherry picking, but it kind of is. But all I have to show is that this year is not horrendously worse than the last worst year. 2018 was their worst year. If this year is more or less in line, then we were concerned about 2018. Why are we concerned about now? Even if there was a 10% increase on the last worst year in the last 5 years, it still wouldn't justify anything. At what point would it justify people saying Sweden should have locked down? Significantly more than a 10% increase on 2018, I would have thought.
And I suppose, too, if you take an actual year rather than an average, then you're getting all the natural spikes as well. So you can kind of compare spikes with spikes and all that sort of
thing. Correct. You could actually compare any year between, and you'll see big gaps between weeks year on year. So the data that you get, that the previous article I mentioned, which you find about a few different outlets have published it, lots of beautiful graphs with red lines, you know. And then people talk about, oh, last week there was a 40% increase of excess deaths. But actually you can pick any year, and find excess deaths all over the place. Year on year, you can, there are always week to week excess deaths when you compare year to year, and especially if you have an average, that's essentially just another line. Of course, there's going to be week to week excess deaths here and there. And yes, we're going through a bit of a bumper death season, and other years have had bumper death seasons. It's whether or not it's enough of a bumper death season to justify, and there's all sorts of ways to present that data in a way which makes it look alarming. So I'm doing the opposite. I'm presenting it to show that actually it's not that alarming if you present it, you know, in another manner.
Yeah, I know when I first heard that we were probably going to go into lockdown soon, I think it's when we first moved to level two or something. And my gut feeling at the time was was sadness for all the lives that it would negatively affect, just the fact that it's a lockdown, rather than the COVID-19. I guess I understood that, you know, like any virus or illness, that there's risks involved with that. But it seems that when a policy imposes restrictions that have negative consequences, that's also kind of something that you can be sorrowful about. You said near the beginning that you're concerned about small to medium-sized businesses. Could you say a little bit more about what your concerns are, in particular as an accountant?
Look, actually, that's the tip of the iceberg. And people think that's sort of what I'm talking about, referring to when I talk about the destruction that an extended lockdown brings. But that's just the tangible side of it. That's the obvious side of it, you know. The businesses that were making ends meet and that will go bust first, and then so on and so forth. But the flow-on effects, not of that, but of other, you know, the larger businesses also going bust, of there generally not being commerce at all. You know, and these are the flow-on effects, you know, are far more than those obvious signs, or this is unprecedented. You know, this is simply hasn't happened before. Second World War, the economy didn't shut down. It was just a whole bunch of men were diverted from creating wealth, but everything trucked along. In fact, for New Zealand, it was great because everyone wanted our stuff. Well, so the meat and the wool and everything flew off the wall. This has never happened before. So even for me, trying to fully comprehend the repercussions beyond the simple business is going to go bust, people are going to have no job, unemployment could go to 20-30% or more, all that sort of thing. No one really has a full grasp of just how bad it's going to be. I just have a better grasp than most. I can think further down the track because I know how it all pieces together to a certain extent. But even I don't even claim to know just how bad it's going to hit us in the end. Very long answer to a simple question.
It's clearly not a simple question. So, I mean, to follow up with that, so you're saying you think it's definitely more than just some businesses going bust. Are there specific negative consequences that you can foresee that you could speak about a little bit?
Okay, so more tangible, understandable consequences. A massive drop in GDP is just completely correlated and non-controversially so with a significant drop in life expectancy. I mean, an easy way to sort of illustrate this is just to look at the countries which have 30, 40, 50% lower GDP than we do. Their health services obviously can't be as good as ours. their quality of life and their life expectancy can't possibly be as good as ours, and they're not. And various studies have been done, you know, I think, I mean, after the GFC, 10, 11, 12 years ago, various outlets estimated an 8% drop in GDP that we had then, equated to a 3-month drop in life, overall life expectancy. But that was only a drop in GDP for a certain period of time, you know, a relatively small period of time. But this could have a lot longer repercussions if we really crash and burn the economy properly. It doesn't recover, but at what, over what time period and at what cost. So that's a tangible way of looking at it. Dropping GDP does bad things.
Yeah.
And you know, you don't have, if you haven't created wealth, how are you going to fund your hospitals? And I mean, that's, you know, and that's on top of the fact that we've burned through, physically burned through billions of dollars, which could have, I don't know, people saying that the cost so far, just in terms of government bailout and the cost to the wealth not created by New Zealand, is something approaching 30 billion, and that have funded at least 20 fully functioning, large scale modern hospitals, you know. So that's 20 hospitals that are no longer funded in the future. You know, that's a very sort of tangible way, simple, simplistic way of looking at it.
Yeah. Yeah, because when people bring up the economy in the current climate, they're often shouted down as if, you know, you're talking about something very abstract, and we, you know, we're talking about saving lives here, you know, and we should be focused on saving lives, not on the economy. So, I mean, what you're suggesting is that while the short term, we might be, the current, the lockdown may be contributing to saving a significant number of lives, and it may not, because I guess that's what your research is questioning. But what is certain is that undermining the economy massively like this is going to have a long-term negative effect on lives, the very lives that we're talking about wanting to save.
That's right. And I'm not denying that, having had our lockdown, we've saved some deaths by or with CV19. Yes, they would have been higher. But whether they, those people, you've got to do a measurement. And my brother did this, and his post actually went just as viral as mine did a few weeks before mine. I don't know whether you've seen it, but he did a calculation earlier on in the piece, assuming the worst case scenarios, assuming 60,000 people dying. Okay, and that we all know now, that was done on the early Imperial College of London models, which just simply aren't given any credit anymore. Well, not the credit they were given at the time. But he used those numbers just to, you know, to be on the safe side. And did the, you know, what if, you know, a GDP drop of even just 8%? And because you've got to look at the people who are dying, what, how many, it sounds a bit callous, but how many years of life do they have left? And if the average age, and it is, of those dying in New Zealand is the life expectancy, and it is what, 81, I think the average age of people have died from CV19, or round about that number, then for mathematical purposes, for statistical purposes, no additional life is being lost. Even if more cases had been allowed to eventuate and die, it doesn't seem that it, and this is the stats from Sweden, so show the same thing. In fact, a number of different countries have done a calculation on the average age, and it's bang on those countries' average life expectancy. So statistically speaking, no years of life are being lost by those dying. And in fact, again, my graph, I've updated my Swedish graph, the one, and I've done an under 65 year line, you know, all cause deaths under 65, and it's totally unaffected. No effect whatsoever. People under 65 may be diagnosed with CV19 and be dying, but it's not affecting the all cause death rate for under 65 year olds. It's the same for a number of different countries that I've looked at. Switzerland was another one like a week or so ago. So if you calculate how many years of life is being lost by CV19, it looks like it really isn't anything. statistically speaking. And people will say, oh, you're talking statistically, people. Statistically speaking, that's callous and unemotional. But, you know, as we all know, you've got to start somewhere. You've got to quantify it. You have to quantify the value of life, of the lives that you're saving, because you're costing elsewhere in terms of lives as well. And if we're decimating our GDP significantly, and we are, thereby lowering all of the entire New Zealand's population average life expectancy, you've got to factor that in. Essentially, it's how much life are we losing across the board, across the entire New Zealand population down the track, compared to the life that we're saving, the years of life that we're saving on these few CV90 candidates, even if we were to allow more of them to die. It's actually a project for me to do, when I find the time, to update my brother's stats to with up-to-date data, now that we have a much clearer picture. And it's just, it's not even close. It's not even close. Even, it wasn't close when he used the worst-case scenarios for New Zealand. It will be even further from being close. The only argument really that I can see against it is that, oh, well, you know, these are very, these lives are with us right now. We can't, you know, we can't factor in something, you know, the lives of you and me and our children, because that's decades down the track. You know, it's like, I don't know. I don't really adhere to that argument at all, because through planning, it's all about time and cost benefit analysis and that sort of thing. And if even if the cost is further down the track, how fair is it to push that on to future generations? Including ours, it's simply not fair.
Yeah. So, I mean, at the beginning of lockdown, when they announced the financial packages that were coming out, and I did ask some questions about all, because I'm not an economist and I'm pretty dim on these in these areas. So I sort of asked, where's the money coming from? And a few people did say, we are kind of taking money from future generations to pay for our current costs, basically to pay for the lockdown. But then if we factor in the relationship between GDP and life expectancy, then it's not just money that we're taking from future generations. You know, that does equate to life, length of life.
Correct. And that's a more tangible, even-handed way to look at it.
Yeah, and it's not, I don't think it's wrong to do an analysis on that level where it's quantitative and it's abstract, because policy is generally made on that level, right? So,
well, that's the thing, and people don't really think about that, but a cancer patient will be turned down treatment if their costs are going to be, you know, here's a hypothetical scenario. If the costs of treatment are going to be 120 grand, but the likelihood of success is tiny, they'll get denied treatment. They have to go on GoFundMe or whatever, try and fund it. Because our system quite rightly says, although it seems callous, if we spend 120,000 on you, we can't spend 120,000, you know, providing medication to thousands of children who need it. Or, you know, you spend it on one person, you can't spend it on the other. Money doesn't grow in trees. You got to quantify the value of someone's life in a given situation. That's the way it is. People don't seem to realize that that's what that happens, but it most definitely does.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it's a tricky one I think we know what we're doing, but to try and put it into words isn't always easy, because you're not putting a monetary value on life as such, but you're kind of putting a monetary limit on what you're willing to spend in order to give someone the treatment that they might need to prolong their life.
Correct.
Probabilities
come into that as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, because there's a lot of unknowns. I guess the whole thing of COVID-19 is full of unknowns, right? Because partly the problem is that it's believed to have originated in China, and China is not known for sharing information freely. So even the fact that China had it first, it didn't really seem to help the rest of the world too much. It just gave us a warning that something bad was coming, but exactly what and how to treat it and how bad it was going to be, it was pretty much anyone's guess, wasn't it? And I mean, it still is, because we don't even know how far through the drama of COVID-19 we are, do we? We haven't sort of come out the other side yet, or nobody has.
No, and I'll almost predict that we are going to have a second wave. We're going into our winter months, and you can't get rid of it. You can't squash it out. So it's going to come back again, which is demoralizing. My only hope is that when it does come back again, presumably with more of a vengeance, because winter conditions allow for it, less vitamin D, just colder, more miserable temperatures our bodies don't enjoy as much, that sort of thing. And my hope is that by that stage, Sweden will be so obviously not the basket case that there won't be an automatic, we need to go back to lockdown.
Well, I think that there will be political reasons to avoid a lockdown when we get to that point. Because, you know, one of the factors going on here, whether you like it or not, regardless of your political leanings, you know, it's obvious that the person in government, or the prime minister, this is like a make or break, isn't it, for someone's career. And so with Jacinda, so far, she's regarded as having done very well, and everyone's applauding her. But I think that if we were to go into level 3 and level 2, and then suddenly it's huge spikes, and then if we went back to level 4, I think all of that praise that she got would start to go bad. And I think she would be in great danger of losing the coming elections if we went back into level 4. So I think from her perspective, there's going to be a resistance to going back.
Yeah, you would think so. But then she may also be operating on the basis of, if cases skyrocket, she's going to look bad as well. And so it might be even more politically safe for her to just say, we have to go back, keep the cases down, because at least she can keep holding that card up, keep the cases down, regardless of the actual net benefit, one way or the other. If it's about elections, then it kind of is. I have a fear that she might just keep cracking it down. I mean, I can't believe it, that the enthusiasm with which the general populace still embraces the lockdown. 65%, I think, something like that. 65%. And that's because it hasn't bitten them properly yet, because many businesses are still actually doing quite lucratively from the wage subsidy. Many of them, they've got large overheads. If they're, a small business operating out of home, or their rent's not particularly high, but you've got a bunch of staff, or you've got it's been 6 weeks. That's wage subsidy has actually been pretty nice. It has been a fully paid holiday for many people. I know other friends who, without getting into detail, I can't believe how many people have applied for it, and it's been a bit of a nice little chunk of cash flow. So it has delayed in people's immediate lives the real effects. And I guess if they think they can do that all over again and spurge another 12 million on bailout, if they think they could just keep printing money, then they could push down the really tangible effects down the road a fair way. So my bet, if I had to go one way or the other, is actually they'll just do another lockdown.
Yeah, I mean, that's a bit scary, because then I suppose it, to me, it seems like if it could be delaying the inevitable, large scale spread of the virus. I know when it was first a threat, it was just in China at that point, but we knew it was going to be a worldwide threat. The thought occurred to me, well, at least it's for us, it's still like end of summer, just moving into autumn, still warm weather. Now is actually good timing for us. The worst timing would be coming to the end of a long, cold winter, where your body is at its weakest. You might say your vitamin D supplies are right down. And so that's when it was hitting a lot of the Northern Hemisphere countries. But for us, I thought, well, at least being in the Southern Hemisphere, we've got an advantage. But we were basically squandering that advantage as we speak.
Correct. Oh God, it's gone. No, yeah. That's why I'm afraid I'm a little bit pessimistic. Takes one case and it's back again.
I guess the other factor that someone mentioned recently was, so there's the large scale GDP and the economy and that sort of thing, but there's also the micro level where it's good for our immune systems that we are constantly exposed to a small amount of infection. And so when you're living a normal life in contact with lots of people, that's what's going on. And so it's basically keeping your immune system on its toes and therefore ready to fight. But by going into our bubbles, we are basically, we're not being exposed to much infection at all. And therefore our immune systems are probably working at a lower level overall. So then once we do open the floodgates, we're more susceptible, as well as it being wintertime. But even if it wasn't, we're already reducing the sort of vitality of our immune systems, perhaps, by what we're doing.
Possibly so, but I'm going to plead ignorant. I'm not completely ignorant, but it's not an area where I'm going to spend a lot of focus on. I'm pretty much a numbers person. But in saying that, I mean, there might be the other way around as well. You know, if we keep social distancing to a large extent, it might actually mitigate a bad flu season. So the fact that we've got low immunity might not mean that we have a blowout. In terms of normal flus and other colds and all that sort of stuff, if people keep themselves completely separate, then technically, then nothing pretty much proliferates. But I also know that actually contact, physical contact, as well as social general contact, is massively correlated to overall well-being. And mitigation of stress. I mean, again, I don't think that's controversial. That's seriously not. Now I know that stress is pretty much the main instigator for heart disease, for heart failure, for strokes, all that sort of stuff. And people think of stress as being a stressful event, but it's more a state of being. Levels of stress. So your hormones. The balance of your hormones, your chemical systems, all that sort of crap, which I have no idea. What is quite clear is that social interaction, stability with your social interaction, and a strong network, regular contact, and physical touch. We know that people who have no physical touch, even if it is just with hugging your teammates and all that sort of stuff, makes a massive difference. That is what I'm mostly concerned about. I mean, that's just gone. I mean, I don't know. That's gone.
I suppose for someone like you with five kids, probably not an issue, but plenty of people living on their own.
But this is the thing, actually. The ironic thing is people think I'm just being a greedy, selfish, that's the first sort of take on my take. But no, I come from a position where actually I'm incredibly well-placed. Even badly run businesses or businesses struggling still need an accountant. So although it will affect us, we're well behind the front lines, put it that way, in terms of the brunt. It'll get to us eventually if it carries on for long enough. It will. But I'm the one sticking up for the people, for the vast 30% of unemployed. Which is quickly getting to that point. I'm not going to be the one standing in the bread line until a long way down the track, unprecedented happenings. I should find out how accountants are doing in Venezuela, maybe, to see how they compare. But yeah. And same with the social side of things. I'm very, very fortunate. So it's not like I'm taking the stance out of a position of desperation for myself or greed or selfishness for my, at least not predominantly anyway.
Yeah. You
know, I would like to be able to go and play indoor cricket and all that sort of stuff, but that's not my main motivation for the starts that I have.
Yeah, yeah, sure. So obviously what's done is done, but moving forward, would you be advocating for an approach like Sweden's where, you know, hopefully we move out of lockdown and then it just becomes up to individual judgment and responsibility?
Yeah, I mean, I just don't see why. I have had no argument to say otherwise, you know. That, you know, it just makes perfect sense, too much sense. You know, protect the vulnerable. We know who the vulnerable are. It just makes too much sense. You know, I'm waiting for a genuine argument against it. There just doesn't seem to be any. I know I'm not the only one. If you follow other people who have been on the ball, on the money, you know, Simon Thornley from the University of Auckland, who got a bit of, and Grant Robertson, I think, you know, the two of the guys who were heading up the, got together a bunch of academics sort of to oppose the restrictions, and they got a little bit of media before they were immediately shouted down. But these are, you know, people in the field. They are still basically proclaiming, you know, on a regular basis, what's wrong with Sweden's approach? What's wrong with Sweden's approach? And that's basically all I'm saying as well. I have been, you know, for quite a number of weeks.
Mm. Do you think there's a philosophical difference at play, say, comparing us and the way we think about policy and politics and the relationship between government and the general public? Is there a difference in philosophy between us and Sweden, do you think?
Again, I'm gonna put the disclaimer in, it's not my field of expertise. Funnily enough, my hunch was Sweden, and this is not a politically correct hunch, is that they at the top may have considered that it was impossible to put a lockdown because they have well-known, very populated, heavily populated areas of social, problematic areas, you know, large areas of immigrant communities, which would be virtually impossible to lock down with hundreds of thousands. And I think that's been well documented that they have, of all the European countries, apart from maybe Germany, but per capita, they've allowed in the most immigrants from Syria and other, you know, various other troubled spots, and that they have had serious social problems as a result. Huge, and there's huge enclaves, you know, whole areas which are pretty much not policed. I think a few months before this went down, there was a report that said that had a decrease in the number of grenade attacks, that sort of thing. And I mean, look, it's not a debatable, it's not a debatable fact that it's not the, what do we call them, native-born Swedes? It's not a politically correct term either, is it? You know.
Right, yeah.
You know where the grenades are coming from. Whether or not the grenades are justified because of, you know, unfairness and poor treatment is one thing, but that they do have hugely problematic areas. A bit like Paris, where I think various parts of Paris have basically not been enforced, they haven't had the lockdown enforced because it's just impossible because of these areas. I do wonder whether that played in the Swedish government's mind.
So,
this is totally impossible. Impractical, we're not going to be able to achieve it, so let's try something else.
Yeah. So basically, objectively speaking, they have large ethnic communities that I guess don't necessarily just blend in with the rest of society, that, you know, and it's quite normal when a large number of people come, you know, from one country to another and they group together. Well, then they've got their own subculture, and that's a strength for them. So that's just a normal human thing, right?
Correct. People prefer their own for better or for worse, that seems to be the thing.
And then, therefore, there's less sort of submission to top-down government policy in some of these groups, perhaps. And if they're if they're large and influential,
and I mean, they'll be poorer. That poor people tend to have less to lose. They do have less to lose. They're more reason to not obey. They could cramp more cramped conditions. They've got less luxury items to distract their minds from the mundane of 5 weeks of lockdown. All those sorts of things. You know, a whole host of different reasons as to why this is going to be a completely impractical scenario. I have done absolutely no research as to, I haven't asked anyone, Sweden's policy makers as to why, but I wouldn't be surprised if that was a serious consideration.
Right, yeah.
Given the violence that has become increasingly, even in the Swedish mainstream media, it's just they haven't been able to turn a blind eye to it, they would surely have been very fearful of a stoking of those tensions lockdown would bring.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay. And so because in New Zealand we don't have those problems, then not really to any large extent.
I feel terrible for the worse off people in South Auckland and other parts, who don't have Netflix and to binge watch. And people, like their 5 week lockdown won't be the same as your and mine 5 week lockdown.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely feel the same way. I've been able to work from home, and I've worked from home in the past, so that's not a major adjustment for me. And I've got three children, and we live in Pukekohe, which is quite a nice town. It's nice for going for walks, and there's lots of parks and reserves. Of course, the kids can't play on the swings, but I've erected a rope swing out the front of my house, so it's kind of
you rebel.
Well, we put it out and we bring it down, so we don't share the rope swing with anyone else.
Right.
So it's more just that I'm kind of in a rural town paradise here, and the weather's been nice. So it's like you said, we're on a little holiday, but I can't help but think about those who are less fortunate now and also moving forward. And perhaps those people their voices are not being heard a great deal as well, right? Because generally the loud voices who like to rant and rave are people like us who have the freedom and flexibility to spend hours answering conflictual Facebook comments.
Yes, that's right. Look, that's right. I know. I was thinking actually, I was discussing with someone else, that, going back to how protected in a way, how I'm well behind the front lines in terms of the effects of this, it's a long, long, I don't see myself ever having to really at some, join a breadline, I mean, that might be presumptuous, but, historically speaking, it's not the lawyers and the accountants, whatever, that find themselves in those positions. What we do find ourselves in the positions of, in Venezuela, is actually, being strung up. That's what, if it gets that bad, Venezuela bad or revolution bad, it's the people like you and me who have dared to speak out that if you end on the wrong side of the argument, get guillotined but that's a pretty extreme. That's a long way down the track. Hopefully we don't become anywhere remotely near that. But, who knows what an extended, repeated lockdown might achieve? If it was recurring, happened over and over again, to keep trying to stamp out the CV-19, I don't know,
Yeah, I was going to say with Sweden, and perhaps as your comments suggest, it's not really a philosophical difference. It's just more of a prudential difference, a political and prudential difference. But the idea of giving citizens the responsibility and the freedom to sort of implement their own measures. And while that's got its problems, of course, like it's fraught with little problems because not everyone's prudence is the same. And so people are going to get upset with one another and all that sort of thing. But still, it seems to me, if you want people to be mature, but you don't treat them as if they are, then they'll never become mature.
Oh, look, no, but I don't even go down that track. People don't want the responsibility, you see. I don't think if they're given the option of being told this is the way that's best for you, as we're seeing, most people are just like, yes, okay, you guys are the experts. You must know what you're talking about. And also, you're on TV. Saw you on the 6 o'clock news. You must know what you're talking about. You know, that's how it is. And this is why I have libertarianism is never, doesn't have a hope in hell, because people don't want it. People don't want responsibility, actually. So when the libertarian says, I'm sorry, I have a libertarian bent, because we know, if you're functioning above a certain level, you know how much better you could spend your own money and how much better you could make, you know, how much more efficient it would be if people like us, if the world was made up of high functioning individuals. But I mean, you know, only 5% of the population are in the position to be a libertarian, because most people actually don't have the capability of being able to make correct choices. I mean, that sounds harsh, but you know, 30%, 50% of the population at least have IQs of less than 80. And then you've got a whole raft of in-betweeners who are not confident in their decisions, and aren't particularly good, you know, or don't rate their ability to decide what the right course of action is. And if you're not one of those, I don't know, top 10 or 15, 20% of people who are like, yes, I know what's best for me, I'm responsible enough, you don't want full responsibility. You'd rather give up some of your freedoms and have been told what to do.
Yeah, I mean, I grant that, but I'm just talking about in terms of lockdown. So rather than a fully libertarian state,
right?
It's really just about going back to, you know, back to normal, but that we're still on a sort of level. There's sort of a certain level of caution. Yeah. People are like, okay, so there's still
encouraging this virus. People to embrace responsibility.
Yes. Yeah.
And it could be done. Yes. And certain respects. Yes.
Yeah.
Because it's done in other respects already. You know. It is. You know. Generally speaking, people keep to the speed limit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Generally speaking, people don't park in disabled car parks.
Hmm.
Yeah. So I agree. Yes. My. My tangent.
That's all right.
Was just to explain that actually, yeah, without encouragement at the least, going back to my tangent, without encouragement, people aren't confident, always confident.
Yeah.
And in a crisis, of course, as we know, a crisis is where a lot of people's confidence dissipates.
Yeah. So I think, we'll maybe wrap up there, but it's been good to discuss these things with you anyway, Jonathan. And obviously we're only part way, we don't know how far, through the COVID-19 crisis. So it'll be interesting to see how things unfold, and let's hope that that things in New Zealand and around the world start to improve. Let's hope that our whatever pessimism we might have is just pessimism and doesn't end up coming through. Do you have any sort of final thoughts or any last words that you want to add to the discussion as a whole?
Keep your eye on Sweden. That's that's my mantra at the moment. I could be wrong in the future. If they skyrocket, fine. Lockdown's a great thing. But regardless of what is else is happening in the world, what other alarming information is coming out, it's not alarming from everywhere, it's alarming actually from various spots, which to look at Sweden, at the very least, they're worth consideration while they are not a basket case. That's a summary of, that's what I encourage people to do. It's a summary, as a summary of my message.
Great. Oh, well, thanks again, Jonathan. And you've been with us, journey on Eager Feet, where we go from the mundane to the sublime and back.